As the opioid epidemic has taken a grip on New Hampshire, hospitals have been inundated with patients suffering from addiction. And not all those patients land in a hospital because of an overdose. They're being treated everywhere, from the nursery to the operating room. NHPR's Jack Rodolico went to Manchester to see how the drug crisis is reshaping one busy New Hampshire hospital.
I visited Catholic Medical Center because it's your typical general hospital. They deliver babies, set broken bones, perform heart surgery. It might be as good a place as any to witness how the opioid crisis is transforming healthcare.
We're on the ground floor of the hospital, and we're walking through the radiology department to the back door of the emergency department.
Dr. William Goodman is the chief medical officer here, and he's our tour guide today.
You know, as your doctor, you sit around and you tell sort of like your war stories.
The first person he introduces me to is an ER doctor named Rory Simmons. She's practiced medicine in tough places. She's treated heroin addicts in Ireland and people with HIV in South Africa.
And the worst war stories I can think of from here in New Hampshire are related to opioid addiction, by far. I have never seen anything like this. I cannot overstate it enough. It is overwhelming, out of control. This is a tidal wave. This is the worst of the worst I've ever seen of anything anywhere.
It's no surprise New Hampshire hospitals are seeing more and more people addicted to opioids. In ERs alone last year, there were 6,000 patients statewide, with more than 1,000 of those being treated right here at Catholic. Those patients are mostly in their 20s and 30s, but they range from newborns to the elderly. Dr. Simmons says they're the sickest of the sick. Some overdose in the field, then die here in the emergency room. Others have serious infections from injecting heroin with dirty needles, infections in their spines or their hearts. Sometimes hospital staff are surprised to learn a patient who's sick is also addicted, says Dr. Goodman.
So we'll have someone who has a bowel problem or a heart problem or their diabetes is out of control and they're addicted to an opioid.
Others come in just looking to get more drugs. As I'm talking with Dr. Simmons, I notice a sign on the wall that, in so many words, warns opioid addicts they shouldn't try to trick doctors into prescribing them narcotics.
When somebody comes in and says, I have lower back pain, your first inside gut reaction is, I'm not giving you painkiller. It's not...
You sort of start from a place of mistrust.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
Next, Dr. Goodman, my guide, takes me upstairs to the intensive care unit. About 40% of opioid addicts who come to the ER here are sick enough to be admitted to the hospital, and a lot wind up in intensive care. Some survive overdoses, but are brain dead. Others are wheeled here to recover from surgeries for infections caused by their drug use. Tracy Fahey has been a nurse at Catholic for 22 years. Fahey says that mistrust of patients addicted to opioids has made her quicker to call security.
So I think we put up our guard a little bit. And then we also can have the family members, friends, so-called friends, also searched so that it's the safety of the nurse.
Think about that. Searching the friends and families of patients. Treating addiction in a hospital just seems to erode trust between doctors and nurses and their patients. One wing of the hospital that has a lot of success with patients addicted to opioids is the special care nursery. That's where I'm introduced to Dr. William Edwards, a neonatologist.
My role is generally taking care of babies with problems.
Edwards says for years, babies born addicted were treated in critical care units, which are these overstimulating environments.
It's taken quite a while for us to actually figure out that that's probably the worst place to manage withdrawal symptoms.
Now, Catholic treats these babies in rooms like the one we're standing in. One bed for mom, one for baby. It's warm and quiet. Once they're here, some babies get morphine to wean off their addiction, but a lot do better without the morphine. Instead, they get a sort of cuddling protocol.
Being held skin to skin, being talked to, sung to, fed. It's pretty simple.
Here's what's not simple about treating all these patients. A hospital can fix the infection or get you through detox. It can't help patients navigate their addiction after they're discharged, which is why so many patients come back again and again. And that's forced another big change at Catholic. Hospital staff are talking more to first responders and treatment centers throughout the city, Dr. Goodman says the goal is to make the hospital a step along the path of addiction treatment, not a revolving door for people who can't get healthy.
Never did I dream that in my quest to reduce disease and suffering, would I be on the first name basis with the chief of police, the attorney general, the mayor. But this problem is so complex. You can't just treat it from in the hospital because you're downstream and it's too late.
Goodman says he'll know the state has turned the tide when fewer opioid addicts are coming through the door and when the ones that do come through can continue healing when they leave. For NHPR, I'm Jack Rodolico.
Dr. Konopka speaking.
The doctor is short, with a mop of white hair, and she's quick to smile. This week, she wears a white polka dot vest, white pants, white shoes. She's originally from Poland. She was first licensed in New Hampshire in the 60s.
And how are you doing?
She says she knows she's unique, that the medical system in this country is changing, and she's refusing to change with it.
Even the last year, a secretary of Medical Society told me that I'm a disappearing species. I said, I know that.
She says she doesn't record anything electronically. Medical history, prescription records, it's all on paper. She says she finally caved and got a computer earlier this year, but it sits in her kitchen. She can't figure out how to use it. And it may not come as a surprise that she doesn't trust the medical skills of most doctors nowadays.
They don't see the patient faces. They don't remember the patient. That's it. They are on computers. And then, according to the guidelines, they are prescribing medication for their patients. If it's a good medications or bad medications, they prescribe because it's guidelines. To me, this is not medicine.
She says she stopped accepting insurance several years ago because she felt pressured by the insurance companies to adopt electronic systems and sign complicated financial contracts. So she charges a flat fee, $50, for an office visit. But now everything is changing. Last month, Konopka agreed to voluntarily surrender her license to settle allegations from the New Hampshire Board of Medicine. The board cites her record-keeping, prescribing practices, and medical decision-making. They say confidentiality rules limit them from offering more detail. Regardless, these are serious allegations, but the doctor's patients seem more upset at the board than her. And those I spoke with, they're not taking it lightly.
She's changed my world, and I'm terrified. I am absolutely terrified.
Nancy Muskelly came in on Monday morning. She says before she started seeing Konopka a couple years ago, she was using a walker or a cane to get around. Now, with Konopka's help, she can walk again, freely. She says she's cut her pill count to a quarter of what it was. She's scared if she has to go to other doctors, her health will again take a turn for the worse.
She listens to you. You know, she really does listen to you.
For her part, Konopka says she's always been careful to follow the law and keep detailed records. She's never been sued for malpractice in New Hampshire. She's agreed to surrender her license, but disputes the allegations and says she's done nothing wrong. Talking with her patients, though, I noticed another trend. Many suffer from chronic pain, say they were referred to Konopka by friends, word of mouth, and say they see her about once a month. Then some of them, like Muskelly, the woman who was using a walker before seeing the doctor, would say things like this.
What do you think is going to happen to these 300 patients that she sees on a month? I can guarantee you half of them now, if whatever they are on, if they can't go to another doctor to get what they need, you know, they're going to go to the streets.
It turns out many of the doctor's patients, more than half, she says, are on opioids to manage chronic pain. Those patients told me Konopka is a savior in part because so few doctors nowadays will take them and keep them on the drugs. Konopka says this problem of people not knowing where to go, it's bad. She had decided this spring she wouldn't take any new opioid patients, but she was overloaded with calls from people begging her to take them on. In some cases, when they told her they'd have to turn to the street, she let them in.
It's a young people, you know, they are dying, you know. I wanted to save them.
She says she's not overprescribing and, in fact, is often able to reduce a patient's dosage. And while, again, the medical board has disclosed only the broad strokes of their allegations, when asked specifically about it, Konopka said her opioid prescribing practices are part of the complaints. For one thing, in New Hampshire, physicians are required to look up patients in an online system when they're prescribing opioids. It helps doctors know when a patient may be abusing the drugs. Konopka says she hasn't been using it. With the extent of the opioid crisis across the country, physicians are under increasing pressure around their prescribing practice. I talked with some doctors who say it's leading to unintended consequences, with some chronic pain patients being cut off from the drugs. For the patients I met in Konopka's office, the system has become scary and exhausting.
Other doctors won't even see me. I've called 30 doctors this week. 30 doctors. And they said, no, we do not take narcotic patients.
Jennifer Clark's been seeing Konopka for about 6 years. In exasperation, she turns her back to me and lifts up her shirt, shows me the scar running up and down her spine. She was in a bad car accident in the 90s. She's adamant that she doesn't abuse the drugs. In fact, she says Konopka's taken her down to half the dose that other doctors had prescribed.
I have perfect records and nothing wrong in my records. And they still say, no, we do not take narcotics. So where am I supposed to go?
Konopka says she's fighting the medical board's decision. She's filed for an injunction in Merrimack County Superior Court and says she's left information for the governor, asking him to step in as well. For NHPR News, I'm Breacha Green.
People on the front lines of the opioid epidemic are coming to see addiction as a medical disorder. And now the city of Nashua's public health department is trying to get everyday people to use vocabulary that reflects that. But as NHPR's Emily Corwin reports, habits can be hard to break.
I'm sitting among 30 or 40 residents of Nashua in the public library auditorium. We're here to learn how to save someone from an overdose by administering the reversal drug Narcan. It's like a CPR class for the 21st century. We're a captive audience, and before the training starts, we get a kind of lecture.
We need to start talking about substance use disorder, like the disease that it is.
Allie McKnight is here with the public health department. She's been giving this talk a lot lately.
I'm asking all of you right now to retire the following words: addict, junkie, and alcoholic.
The idea is to encourage society to see addiction as a disease and to stop labeling its victims as moral failures. Eric Eastman is sitting in the audience. He says the rising opioid death toll here has left him with a sense of obligation to help. But still,
the idea that we have to replace a whole set of vernacular with a whole new set overnight, I think that's some heavy lifting there, but I get where they're going with it, and I think it's constructive.
In fact, the initial push to change the language around addiction was specifically geared toward federal agencies and medical practitioners. Obama White House drug czar Michael Botticelli was behind it. He says the recommendations were based on research.
That even among trained clinicians, when you call someone a substance abuser, they're more likely to treat that person punitively.
Botticelli is talking about a study from Mass General Hospital. It compares two sets of mental health providers. One received a survey referring to patients as substance abusers. The other got the same survey, except it referred to people, quote, with substance use disorder. The health providers, it turned out, were more likely to recommend things like jail time to the, quote, abusers, and more likely to recommend medical treatment to the people with a, quote, disorder. Different labels led to different outcomes. But what about that old tenet of recovery, that you have to own your addiction with statements like this?
Hi, I'm Sarah, and I'm an addict in recovery.
This is how Sarah Longval says she likes to introduce herself at recovery group meetings. I met with her and two other women at an addiction recovery center in Concord. Another woman named Dawn Torregrossa explains coming to terms with the phrase, I am an addict, helped her seek help.
That denial can last for a really long time. It's when that light bulb goes on that you go, I am an addict, and I have, like, a serious problem. A lot of people have to hit rock bottom before they come to those terms.
Everyone I talked to made it clear that people in recovery should use whatever words they choose to describe themselves. Still, it seemed to me that this phrase, I am an addict, had actual utility for some people at the recovery center. I put this to Michael Botticelli from the Obama administration.
I've been a member of a 12-step group organization for a long time.
The former drug czar who got this effort underway, he's in recovery too. He says that whole I am an addict admission, it's useful, but only when the medical community has fallen down on their job.
We can do a better job at intervening with people before they have to hit rock bottom.
His point is, doctors don't wait for someone with heart disease to have a heart attack before they prescribe statins. And they wouldn't wait for a diabetes patient to confess, "I am a diabetic," before prescribing insulin. So he says, why do that with people who have substance use disorder? It's a question for medical professionals, and perhaps for the rest of us, too. For NHPR News, I'm Emily Corwin.
Just be hyper, hyper vigilant of what's out there. Hyper vigilant of where you put your hands, what you come in contact with.
That's Chris Hickey. He's the EMS officer for Manchester Fire. He held two training sessions on Wednesday for the city's 60-plus firefighters. This kind of drug is unlike anything they've dealt with before. It's designed to be used as a tranquilizer for elephants, and its lethal dosage is just 20 micrograms, which is as tiny as a snowflake. Even getting it on your skin could be deadly.
There's nothing out there other than going in hazmat suits on every single overdose that's going to completely protect us. We just have to be super, super careful with it.
And treating overdoses isn't too simple either. Hickey says in the past few weeks, his guys have had to use 6 to 8 doses of the overdose reversal drug Narcan to revive someone, more than twice the normal dose. Dr. William Goodman is the CMO at Catholic Medical Center in Manchester, where they treat overdoses on a daily basis. Now that carfentanil is in the picture, he says Narcan may not be enough to do the trick.
Usually Narcan is stronger than heroin, so it outcompetes and it blocks the receptor, and heroin can't trigger the mu receptor. That's how it works. But carfentanil is so strong, it outcompetes the Narcan. So it would be an arms race of drugs, you know, the drug versus the antidote.
But Goodman says he isn't aware of any other antidote on the market. So for now, multiple doses will have to do. There's no shortage of Narcan, but the state will likely need a lot more, not just to treat drug users, but also first responders who may need it in case of exposure.
In his late 20s, Christopher Milford got high on some OxyContin his friend gave him. By his early 30s, he was shooting heroin and Suboxone. Milford would reuse the same needle for a week or more. And one day, out of the blue, he was so sick he couldn't get out of bed.
Felt like the worst flu I ever got in my life. Almost felt like a dream. I started doing weird things, like putting PlayStation controllers in the sink, in the bathroom. It was just weird off the wall.
Milford had endocarditis, essentially an abscess on one of his heart valves. He spent 7 weeks in the hospital on IV antibiotics. Then things got worse. He went back home, he kept shooting drugs, and he got endocarditis 2 more times. Milford eventually quit drugs, but after 6 months sober, he was smoking a cigarette one day, and he kept dropping it. A few minutes later, he couldn't talk.
I wrote stroke on a piece of paper, handed it to my mother. She called the ambulance. I couldn't talk. It was scary. The scariest feeling in the world. And that's why I'm talking like I am.
Milford's stroke wasn't half the damage endocarditis did to him. He would undergo 2 heart surgeries to implant a pacemaker and replace his infected valve. At the time, he was 35 years old.
So this is surgeries for endocarditis that's associated with IV drug use.
Jonathan Ettinger, a cardiologist at Catholic Medical Center in Manchester, didn't treat Christopher Milford, but he's showing me spreadsheets he made to track patients like Milford. Ettinger says IV drug abusers who undergo heart valve replacement surgery have about a 1% mortality rate at his hospital. But those patients are likely to keep using drugs when they leave. So Ettinger wondered, how long do they survive outside the hospital?
Like, it's frustrating because I don't have a decent way of tracking them and knowing what's happening to them, because we'd like to know how they're doing.
To figure out how they were doing, Ettinger did something a little unusual. He took lists of patients going back 5 years, and he started Googling their names.
What I did is I went and I used the internet to figure out if they died afterwards and follow up.
Ettinger looked for obituaries for the hospital's patients who had their heart valves replaced. All of these patients were IV drug abusers, and he learned 25% had died. And the spreadsheets show something else troubling. These folks were super expensive to treat.
So the folks that come in with endocarditis two or three times are costing
half a million dollars. That's exactly right.
In 2011, Catholic Medical Center treated three IV drug abusers with endocarditis. Last year, they saw 51. Most were young, in their 20s and 30s, and most were on Medicaid. Hospitals around the country are seeing this same trend, but no one is tracking the total numbers, and that means no one's adding up the total tab. Nancy Texera, the director of Catholic Medical Center's cardiovascular surgical unit, says the treatment for endocarditis doesn't always work if the patient is an IV drug abuser.
Well, we've had people come in, get their valves done, and go back out and use, and they either die or they show up in extremis because they've used again and now they've reinfected their new valve and they're right back at square one.
Texera is left struggling with some thorny questions, like how many times should you replace the same heart valve? There are no ethical guidelines for treating this patient population, so Catholic Medical Center is one of the first to write some. The guidelines call for setting patients up with drug treatment, says Dan Daly, a medical ethicist with St. Anselm College who helped write them. Daly says what the guidelines are not is some kind of moral test.
This is not the patient proving to the medical team that they are worthy of a new valve, that they are worthy of the surgery, that we wanted to make sure that that could not happen.
Dr. Jerome Kassirer is the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. He says whatever Catholic Medical Center comes up with will probably be helpful for doctors and nurses around the country who are making this up as they go.
There's always an incentive to do right for every individual patient. And as a consequence, they're going to opt for treating the patient as if the patient wasn't addicted.
Chris Milford's addiction is what caused his endocarditis, and endocarditis is what drove him to quit drugs. He's 2 years sober and still trying to regain his voice.
The damage is already done, but I've been clean ever since, and always that desire to start using drugs at all.
What's unclear is how many more people are still stuck in a cycle of IV drug abuse that's causing deadly infections, driving a complex ethical debate, and swelling a massive price tag. For NHPR, I'm Jack Rodolico.
Is the house manager here, Dino?
No, we're just doing a walkthrough from some of the recovery housing. And she's doing.
Oh, yeah, this isn't a recovery house anymore.
It's not. Okay.
Okay, yeah. Good.
All right.
The reason the fire department suspected this place was running a recovery house is they visited it several times before for overdose calls. And Chief Goonan believes it's still operating.
You know what? I'll bet you $1 million that this is sober living.
The house was falling apart. Chip paint everywhere, overgrown grass, and trash in the yard. The next house, a similar situation.
How are you?
Hi.
Is there like a house manager here? Last time I was here, there was like a house manager that kind of gave us a... Yeah, he's not here.
Tour. Okay.
With the demand for this type of housing so high, places like this have been running under the radar. Some maybe not for the right reasons. If you do the math, with an average rent of $150 a week and 12 people in a house, that comes out to $7,200 a month, or more than $86,000 a year. So the profit is definitely there. These concerns are not just limited to Manchester. Nashua seems to be experiencing similar problems, and officials in places like Keene and Concord suspect it's happening too. Cheryl Pacapelli ran sober living houses for 15 years. She says some places have good intentions, but just don't understand how much work it is.
You know, you have to provide them with an ear and a way to find a job. And, you know, it's 24/7 if you're running a good house.
That's why more than 20 states, including Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Maine, have some form of set standards and policies these houses have to live up to, such as occupancy. John Carter was the youngest of four children. Most people in his hometown of Pelham, New Hampshire, knew him as Bubba. He had big blue eyes and a smile his family says was contagious.
So many people loved him. Teachers loved him. Parents of friends loved him. He was the most generous, loving person I knew.
John's older sister, Kaylin Bigger, gave him his nickname when he was a baby. His father, Jack Carter, says John started doing drugs as a teenager, but the family struggled to get him help.
His sister had seen track marks on his arm, and we need to do something. So I came to her house and went over to the Pelham Police Department and asked them for help.
They spent probably 45 minutes just trying to talk to him. They stressed that we wish there was something we could do, but right now our hands are tied.
John's family thought the best way to help him might be a pretty extreme option, forcing him into treatment to get him away from the drugs.
You're not thinking clearly. The disease is calling the shots. The drugs are calling the shots. But if you give yourself a little bit of time to clear your head and have that moment of clarity, then you might be able to make some good decisions.
But after they left the police station, John fell back into his drug habit.
He passed away 2 weeks later of an overdose of fentanyl.
This was July of last year. John was 18. The forced treatment John's family was looking for is known as involuntary commitment. It allows a family member, police officer, or doctor to ask a judge to mandate treatment. About 40 states have some version of involuntary commitment on the books, but it wasn't available for John in New Hampshire. His family never got the chance to find out if it might work, but one of John Carter's high school friends did get that chance, Savannah Mayberry. She moved to Dracut, Massachusetts after graduation. Mayberry is 21, but like John, she fell into drug use as a teenager. Massachusetts does allow involuntary commitment. There, they call it being sectioned, a reference to the state law. Her mother, Tracy, forced Savannah into treatment last November. Tracy Mayberry vividly remembers the overdose that almost killed her daughter.
She told me that day in the hospital, "I'm not done using." And I was like, "Oh, hell yeah, you are." I couldn't do it. As a parent, just watch her suffer.
Savannah remembers that moment, too.
Went home that night, and I had woken up the next morning to cops in my house, along with my parents.
We went to the courthouse. They had her downstairs in the holding cell. We waited for her case to be presented to the judge. He deemed her to be sectioned. And that a few hours later, I think she was held at the police station for a few hours. And then they took her that night to the Women's Addiction Treatment Center in Bedford. Other than losing three family members in my life, this was the hardest thing I ever had to do. But I would do it again.
Savannah spent over a month in treatment. She resisted it at first, but since then, she's come to believe that involuntary commitment saved her life. She can't help but wonder how it could have helped her friend John.
Sometimes I don't think people are ready to get the help on their own. I think that they need that extra push to get a taste of what sobriety really looks like.
Last spring, lawmakers considered bringing this policy to John's home state of New Hampshire. John's family was the first to testify. But plenty of people think involuntary commitment is a bad idea. One argument is that if addicts haven't made their own decision to get help, they won't stick with treatment. In New Hampshire, there's already a shortage of treatment beds, and state lawmakers were reluctant to spend money on any more, so the legislation was shelved. John's mother, Cheryl Mercer, has a unique perspective on this. While she lives in Pelham, New Hampshire, she works just a few miles across the state border as a cop in Lowell, Massachusetts. In that job, she has personally asked a judge to send addicts into treatment.
I have the capability to walk into a courtroom if I know somebody's a harm to themselves or others because of drugs and section them. I can do that at my job at any time. But once I cross the border and I get to New Hampshire, I couldn't help my own child.
Advocates say this policy is no silver bullet. But for some families, it could be the only option that works. For NHPR News, I'm Paige Sutherland.